Let's begin to listen to one another again. Hear one another. See one another. Show respect to one another. Every disagreement doesn't have to be a cause for total war. And we must reject the culture in which facts themselves are manipulated and even manufactured. We must end this uncivil war that pits red against blue, rural versus urban, conservative versus liberal. We can do this if we open our souls instead of hardening our hearts, if we show a little tolerance and humility, and if we're willing to stand in the other person's shoes, as my mom would say, just for a moment, stand in their shoes.
In the era of populism and political polarization, listening to the other side has become harder than ever. Even agreeing to a common starting point, a set of facts about the world, has come to seem impossible. To many of us, it feels like our political and cultural opponents just live in a different world, a different reality from us. One side sees climate change as real and dangerous, requiring imminent action, while the other side dismisses it as political propaganda for a green agenda. One side sees the coronavirus pandemic as a threat to life, requiring emergency state intervention, while the other side sees exaggerated claims of danger and an excuse for curbing our civil liberties. Facts have become politicized, and their acceptance or denial a sign of one's political identity. On top of that, much of our political discourse takes place in an environment not conducive to civil debate and exchange of ideas, social media. Trolling, antagonizing memes, and conflict entrepreneurs deliberately raise the temperature and short-circuit any chance of honest and truthful communication. So is there a way to talk to the other side, to really engage with the viewpoint of our opponents, to understand their lived experience? And what can philosophy teach us about productive and unproductive ways to argue with one another? Welcome to The Philosopher and the News. I'm Alexis Papazoglou. It's a real pleasure to have as my guest today Elizabeth Anderson. There aren't many philosophers who get profiled in the New Yorker magazine, but Elizabeth Anderson is one of those rare exceptions. She is the John Dewey Distinguished University Professor and the John Rawls Collegiate Professor at the University of Michigan, and that is only two of her titles. In 2019, she delivered the Your Hero Lectures at the University of Oxford under the title Can We Talk? Communicating Moral Concern in an Era of Polarized Politics, which are currently being turned into a book. Elizabeth Anderson has a knack for using political and moral philosophy, as well as social science, to think through issues that affect our everyday lives and that political philosophy doesn't usually dare to engage with. I couldn't think of a better philosopher to both diagnose the causes of our failure to communicate across the political divide, as well as provide us with insights into how we can relearn to talk with the other side. Elizabeth Anderson, welcome to the Philosopher and the News podcast.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So, Elizabeth, are you secretly Joe Biden's speechwriter? In his inauguration speech, Biden said the following. He said, "Let's begin to listen to one another, hear one another, see one another, show respect for one another." Your 2019 You Hear lecture seemed to be a plea for some of the very same things, and you're offering a kind of recipe for how to achieve them. Is this now a politically polarizing view that it's come from a president that 70% of Republican voters believe is illegitimate?
To listen to somebody is a way of showing respect. And even if the other side says that Democrats, liberals, what have you, don't deserve respect, to show respect is itself to enable an opening from the people who are being listened to, that they can recognize that respect. So that's why we have to very patiently and calmly listen, because that's the only possible opening to enabling the other side to then begin to hear. Mm-hmm. Reciprocity is critical.
So, yeah, so you hear a lecture that you gave in Oxford, I guess, a year and a bit ago now, are all about the ethics of communication. And your aim, as I understand it, is to kind of try and articulate the conditions that would make possible a kind of constructive discourse across political divides, identity divides, in order to enhance our democracy. And in your first lecture, you offer a kind of diagnosis of what has gone wrong with our discourse, specifically our discourse around facts over the past few years of especially the Trump presidency. We heard talk of alternative facts. The mainstream media were dubbed fake news. There was talk of entering into a post-truth era where shared reality of facts was no longer available as a kind of starting point for political discourse. How did we arrive at that place?
Well, this has been going on. This kind of polarization of facts has been going on for several decades now. I would say maybe going back to the 1990s. Mm-hmm. A lot of it is driven by right-wing media, the rise of Fox News, but more recently by social media and the way social media algorithms are designed to amplify polarizing voices and outrage, and because that's what grabs people's attention. So social media profits, the longer you pay attention to something, the more money they make on their ads. And the algorithms have discovered that polarizing discourse, which arouses outrage and fear, holds people's attention and keeps them online on the site. And so those are the voices that get amplified. And how do you arouse polarization and fear? By telling lies or presenting facts in a very misleading way in order to arouse fear and anger. So this has been commodified, it's commercialized. Fox News, the master of it, but not just that. Rush Limbaugh, Alex Jones, conspiracy thinking, right?
Yeah.
All of this stuff makes enormous amounts of money for the people who are promulgating it. And that's why we hear this more and more. And it's driving us into, right, unreality.
Right. So now there are certain businesses, what you're saying, there are certain businesses whose their business model is exactly to kind of promote polarization. So to promote the kind of speech that does exactly that. So the kind of speech that is more like trolling, calling people out. You mentioned antagonistic memes in your talks, spreading misinformation. And one of the strategies that you suggest as a way of tackling these things is to try and isolate those people who thrive on this type of speech. You call them conflict entrepreneurs. Now, in my mind, I thought you just meant people like Alex Jones or maybe even people like Donald Trump. And I was going to ask you, do you think that, you know, not having Trump on social media platforms since a few days ago will have a measurable impact on public discourse? But are you saying here that the very media platforms that promote and thrive on this speech are kind of part of the problem? So conflict entrepreneurs, not just individuals, but, you know, Facebook and Twitter as a whole.
Oh, I agree completely that social media bears significant responsibility. But I want to distinguish between two things. One is elite discourse and one is citizen-to-citizen discourse. Mm-hmm. So mostly what I'm talking about is citizen-to-citizen discourse. These are people who don't hold political office, who are not major media pundits or people on TV all the time, or people running the major media outlets. I'm not that. That's what I'm calling elite discourse. These are people who are very powerful, very wealthy, who have huge megaphones. Mm. Okay, what I'm concerned about is citizen-to-citizen discourse, and that's what you find more on social media. Mm-hmm. So it's inherent in political discourse where citizens are communicating with politicians, that citizens have the right to hold politicians to account. And some of that discourse can be very critical. And politicians had better get a thick skin. They're not entitled to complain, right? Because that's just inherent in democratic politics. Now, that doesn't mean anybody should be communicating death threats. That's well beyond, right, the acceptable. And indeed, it's criminal activity. Any kind of expression of threats, death threats, rape threats expressed towards anyone is a gross violation. It's criminal conduct. It has no proper place anywhere. And whether you're directing it to the top or just to a fellow citizen, it's completely out of line. But my focus is, how do we talk to each other, just ordinary voters, ordinary citizens, people who aren't holding office or have, you know, particular, you know, exalted positions in the media with huge megaphones, so to speak. And that's where I want to say, on social media, if somebody, say, is concerned trolling or arguing in bad faith, you don't pile on and respond, because that just gives them more attention, which is what they're looking for. You seek out forums that are properly moderated so that you can actually have an intelligent discussion. And those moderated forums are going to kick the trolls off, because trolls all. So it turns out, for instance, that Reddit is relatively better than some of the other social media platforms, because the views that are promoted are the views that other readers find useful and upvote. Whereas on Twitter, the stuff that gets promoted is the stuff that just gets a lot of attention, right? Please stop paying attention to the trolls and the horrible people, and don't try to just pile on the refutations, because that just promotes their views with the algorithms.
Yeah, since you've kind of brought this up implicitly, one of the things that you mentioned that is a problem in how we conduct speech and communicate with each other is emotions, right? And emotions are a kind of culprit in what you identify as causing communication breakdowns. And often the kind of phenomenon that you're describing might be caused by emotions like anger. So you see someone post something that makes you incredibly frustrated or angry at them, and you kind of want to reply and respond in some way. But other emotions as well, emotions of fear or resentment, contempt is another emotion you highlight. My question is, when it comes especially to certain, you know, marginalized communities or even brutalized communities, one might argue that some of that emotional response is justified, right? It's a justified reaction to what someone is saying or a current situation or an event. So how do we try and manage these emotions and kind of, you know, bracket them in some way so that we have a more constructive discussion about changing things?
Of course, it's totally justified for people to say, be outraged at police violence against people of color, or indeed against anyone, right? The issue here is what emotions to express and to foreground when one is communicating to fellow citizens who disagree. Okay. And just to throw back, right, the anger at them is both ineffective, because it's just going to raise their hackles, but it also represents a failure to understand where they're coming from. Okay. Because they've got fear too. So just look at defund the police, or say discourse about gun control. What we have to understand first is why the other side finds it so critically important to hang on to guns and support the police, and get some psychological insight into that. It's fear. Fear is driving this. And when people are afraid, their cognition shuts down. They don't want to hear like statistics about how people use guns mostly to kill themselves, their family members, their friends and neighbors, or it happens in accidents. Okay. They don't want to hear that. What they feel is there's a lot of threat out there and real crime and real danger. And they feel in order to feel safe, I got to carry a gun. You know, here I am in very low crime Ann Arbor. I don't feel unsafe, but other people are in other situations. You have to understand that.
Yeah.
To have an intelligent conversation. And first you have to be receptive to and show empathy for the fact that other people are in much more dangerous situations and resort to arming up as a way to feel safe. Okay. If you don't hear that, they think you just don't care about us, you know?
Mm-hmm. Before we get deeper into some of the solutions that you offer, amongst which is kind of, yeah, this more empathetic stance towards the other side, seeing the other side's perspective, where they're coming from, I want to stay a little bit longer on the kind of diagnosis of the problem. So
yeah.
one of the things you diagnose as part of the current discourse is something you call the populist economy of esteem. And from what I understand it, it's something about esteem being understood as a zero-sum game. If you gain esteem and I don't like you and you disagree with me, I lose esteem. So can you tell me a little bit more about this concept and how it sort of short circuits our discourse these days?
Yeah, so can we step back and just think a little bit about populism? Because populism now is a worldwide trend across almost all the democracies. You know, we see it also in Hungary, Poland, Marine Le Pen in France. The Brexit campaign was fundamentally a populist campaign.
Yep.
It's in India, in Turkey. It's all over the place. Okay. We have to understand populism. I'm going to focus in particular on the version that's most prevalent in North America and Europe, which is right-wing populism. Right-wing populism is a mode of activating or mobilizing political support through a kind of rhetorical strategy that explains the meanings of political events in terms of elites who are betraying the real people by promoting the interests and esteem of traditionally or historically subordinated groups above the real people. Okay. So who are those people? LGBT, Muslims in many democracies, people of color, Jews. Well, Jews actually are the elites, right? There's always dog whistling. George Soros, right, is, conspiring supposedly to bring in waves of immigrants to overwhelm white Christian Americans. Now, what's important about populist discourse is that it doesn't really offer policies that offer material benefit objectively to the people they're appealing to. Instead, it's all about complaining that elites are putting you down, have contempt for you. It's symbolic. It's representational. It's addressing the feeling of cultural decentering and cultural demotion. So it addresses the resentment that white Christians feel that now all those elites hold contempt for them because they're so transphobic, homophobic, racist, and so forth, right? And they feel resentment at those feelings, but they also resent the people beneath them, trans people, gay people, right, immigrants, people of color, and so forth, because they feel that those people are being promoted above them in the scale of social respect and esteem. And elites are the ones who are controlling the esteem ranking, okay? And they're being displaced and reduced, relatively speaking. So almost all populist discourse is actually taking place in symbolic and cultural terms rather than material terms, like how much money people get,
right, okay? Yeah. I've heard you describe it as queue jumping, that people are frustrated. They feel, well, queue jumping is the British way, cutting in line.
Yes, exactly.
They describe it as some people cutting in front of them. They've been waiting patiently for, you know, their promise kind of fulfillment of the American dream or whatever, and they feel like someone is cutting in front of them. Why is that? Why are those the terms in which they kind of understand that? Is it because of the framing by populist politicians?
Absolutely. It's the framing of relative position. So, like, you know, the Brexit campaign notoriously explicitly articulated a queue jumping argument that, you know, the national health system was letting immigrants cut in line.
Yeah.
Ahead of the real English, right? Right? Now, that was a lie. In fact, you had years of Tory policy gutting the national health system, so people had to wait longer. But it's very important to understand that ordinary citizens do not have access to large-scale social causation. That takes like a lot of social scientific research to figure out what's really going on. And ordinary people don't have that, okay? They rely on elites to explain to them the causes of their frustration, okay?
And in fact, when we do have reports, they show the opposite. They show that there isn't a kind of a negative impact on wages. Say this is a current, this is sometimes a worry on the side of the left as well, that immigration might be cutting down wages. But the research, at least so far, seems to suggest that is not the case. That doesn't actually happen.
Correct. But now think about populist strategies, which are, you can't trust the elites. And the elites are any kind of knowledge workers, experts, as well as cultural workers who tend to lean left. So if you cast them as hating the real people in the middle, the virtuous people, then you can't believe anything they say. Even if it's grounded in facts and meticulous research and is done with utmost care. So populist discourse is also a mode by which populist political leaders gain a license to say whatever they like without regard for the truth, because they could just dismiss like journalists, knowledge workers, scientists. Well, you're just elites. Like, you just hate, you know, you hate us, right? So why should we believe anything you say?
You're listening to The Philosopher and the News. I'm Alexis Papazoglou. Today I'm talking to Elizabeth Anderson about why it's become so hard to communicate with our political opponents and how we can make it possible again. To communicate with me, write to me on Twitter at newsphilosophy or email me at newsphilosopher@gmail.com. So to leave this kind of populist reason behind your diagnosis about the kind of current political environment in which our discord has broken down, one of the things that you also put your finger on is that when we talk about facts these days, there's always a subtext, right? We're not really talking about facts. You say this about the liberal side or the left side as well, right? That when we throw statistics at people online or when we put links to New Yorker articles or whatever, it isn't only that we are, you know, showing people the facts. We're also doing something else. We're expressing our identity, and you call this identity expressive discourse. And you say that this is another reason why our kind of discussion around facts seems to break down. Can you say a little bit about what exactly is identity expressive discourse, and is it always bad?
Yeah. Look, so identity expressive discourse is any kind of expression that's just upholding a sense of the dignity and worth of one's own team or, right, whatever identity groups one belongs to. Any kind of discourse where you're standing up for your side, cheering it on, right? And, you know, there's nothing inherently wrong with such discourse. You know, you're a fan of a sports team, and so you
cheer it on. Yeah,
you have logo wear. You wear logo wear. Okay, that's completely innocent. Okay, nothing wrong with it in general. what's wrong with identity and expressive discourse is when you use the medium of factual claims, purportedly or ostensibly factual claims, to express pride in your own side, okay? Because then you've hijacked empirical discourse that's supposed to be attentive to the facts and use it for some other purpose. Mm-hmm. And one of the features of populist discourse is that it's all identity expressive. It's like it's trained people to think that whatever somebody says, it's simply an attempt to raise the esteem of their own mm-hmm. side by means of putting the other side down, right? And you know, if you're in that mindset that you're always going to interpret whatever the other side says as some kind of insult,
right?
Some way to put you down, even when it's facts, okay? Then you're never going to hear the facts for what they are. So take an example. COVID is a hoax. Mm. In fact, Trump repeatedly said the only reason why liberals and Democrats and elites are talking about COVID is to make him look bad.
Right.
He's solely concerned about how he looks. Mm. And of course, because his followers identify with him, okay, when somebody tries to make him look bad, they feel that's an attempt to put them down too. And that's why in the United States, you have people who defiantly, you know, refuse to wear masks, and even tear off the masks of other people because they see mask wearing as itself an insult. They see mask wearing now, and Trump turned this, you know, he could have made a different choice. Mm. He could have said to his supporters, this pandemic is really dangerous. We have to hang together and you know, you got to protect your own lives. Here, I'm selling a MAGA mask to you. And he could have made millions.
Right. Like,
selling MAGA masks, and they would all wear it proudly as a sign of how they're helping their president and helping the country by saving lives. But he didn't do that, right? So then now you wear a mask in a red district in the United States and other people not wearing masks look at you and they think you're just wearing a bumper sticker telling them that they're stupid and evil. No wonder they're tearing masks off other people's faces, right? Because they interpret this not as a prudent public health measure based on facts and evidence, but as an assault on who they are.
The most striking example of this, I think you talk about it in your lectures, is the pictures, the photos of Trump's inauguration and the questions that people were asked about which inauguration had more people, Trump's or Obama's. And, you know, it was plain to the naked eye which of the two had more people. And yet Trump supporters had caught on to the fact that this was no longer a mere kind of vision test. This was a test of kind of allegiance almost. And so they would just double down and say, no, that picture has more people. The Trump picture had more people,
exactly.
Even though plainly it didn't.
No, that's right. But here's the point is that, look, it's insulting to ask somebody which of two pictures where one obviously has way more people than another has more people. Right? They're thinking, what, you think I'm an idiot? And then they think, well, that can't really be what's going on. They just are putting these two photos side by side just to insult my side. Right? Mm-hmm. And so then they respond in kind. Yeah. And that's how, when liberals, Democrats, and so forth cite facts that imply a criticism of the policies and behavior of their side and their political leaders, they've been trained by decades of right-wing media to see in that nothing but elite contempt for them. And sometimes it is. So this is important.
Yeah.
It's that I'm really speaking to my side, liberal elites, and saying, cut it out. Because a lot of the time, liberal elites are doing the same thing and falling into the trap of citing this stuff on the assumption the other side, what? Are you stupid? Are you evil? And once you do that, you've confirmed everything the populace have been saying. Yeah. And then...
And resentment comes as an answer.
Of course. Yeah. And of course it comes as an answer because liberals have not spent time to think from the standpoint of the citizen who supports the populace. Yeah. Liberals assume it's just obvious that certain things are facts. Okay. So you must either be stupid for not knowing that or evil for repudiating, say, how dangerous COVID is. Okay. And what I want to say is people who have been exposed to very different media sources have a radically different understanding of reality. And it's also rooted in their own personal experience.
Right. So apart from facts, we obviously also disagree about moral values, and political disagreements often are about those rather than disagreeing about hard facts. If talking about facts like how many people are in a particular space difficult, is talking about our moral values going to be even harder than that? And what are some of the fundamental disagreements around moral values that you see are the most pertinent right now in the U.S.?
Well, actually, I think disagreement about facts is driven by disagreement about value. If you look, say, at climate change denialism, whether human beings are heating the earth to catastrophic consequences is simply a matter of scientific fact. Okay. But yet the reason why people resist that is because they're looking ahead to the inevitable political implications of that. It's obviously outrageous and horrible to let millions of people die from rising sea levels and, you know, burning forests and all this kind of stuff.
Right.
And really the only credible way to deal with climate change is with a massive scaling up of state capacity to change environmental regulations, to change how utilities work, to mandate alternative energy and so forth. And so people whose understanding of how society should be organized is opposed to massive collective action that's state directed, right? They don't want to go there, right? They find it threatening to institute a mode of political organization that is more democratic and egalitarian. They feel safer in a hierarchical mode of organization and one that stresses the individual rather than the collective. Okay. So they resist. And this is all coming from Dan Kahan's wonderful research and the cultural cognition program. And there are many other researchers who are involved. Anyone who wants to understand why people resist scientific facts about the risks of various activities needs to look at Kahan's research. I think it's the best out there. Kahan has an appointment at Yale Law School, but in fact, he's doing social psychology and the science of communication about science. And you just got to look at cultural cognition. You Google it, you have an amazing array of research where you could see how people respond. Kahan stresses, by the way, that everybody is affected by cultural cognition on the left as well.
Course, yeah. So what is cultural cognition exactly? One way you described it is that the way we assess risks and threats is a reflection of our cultural worldviews and our kind of cultural conditioning.
Correct.
What has that got to do with climate change in this particular case?
There are many ways to measure social identity, but the way they do it in the cultural cognition research program is through intersections of two values. So one of them is individualism versus collectivism. Mm-hmm. Do you think we should just rely on our own resources to deal with problems, or do you think we need to get together in larger groups and cooperate in a more collectivist way? And a second axis of disagreement, and this is a values disagreement, is whether you favor hierarchy or egalitarian modes of organizing society.
Yeah.
Okay. These are orthogonal. Okay. And so you could place people in any one of four grids, depending on their combination. And the strongest disagreements are between the hierarchical individualists who like free markets because then everyone's responsible for whatever happens to them, right? And they like hierarchy as well, because, you know, corporations are private, for-profit corporations are hierarchically organized and they're very comfortable with that. Mm. Versus the egalitarian collectivists, these are people who like equality and democracy and, you know, large state capacity and social insurance and things like that, right? So we have a values war. Yeah. And the critical thing is for both sides, any kind of sense of threat to one's own social identity is something that is resisted. We all resist threats to our social identities or our fundamental value commitments. And so factual information that threatens that is something we resist. Okay. And this is a universal. Hmm. And Kahan has shown that it happens on the left as well. It's not like the left has monopolized accurate cognition of factual information. Okay.
What would be an example of the left sort of not being able to face the facts or feeling uncomfortable with the facts when it comes to the way they've been culturally conditioned and their cultural biases?
Oh, like the purported dangers of consuming genetically modified organisms.
Mm-hmm.
There really isn't any.
People freak out about GM foods, even though there is no scientific basis for it. Right.
Right.
Okay.
So that'd be like a classic example on the left.
How does this, Kahan's work on cultural cognition relate to something else you talk about redescribing certain things? So when you talk about climate change in your talks, you say, well, you know what? The people that know about climate change the best are farmers and they know it and they are worried about it because it might affect their livelihood. But a lot of farmers are not necessarily Democrat voters, and so they don't like the term climate change or global warming, and they refer to it in different ways. They talk about, you say somewhere, fluky weather. Is redescribing the facts in a language that is seen as less politicized and less sort of value-laden a helpful strategy in getting people to talk about the facts?
So there are two things. One is I recommend avoiding terms that are understood by the other side as just an insult.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Right. And it turns out that due to the enormous power of right-wing media, right, climate change has turned into such a term. But in another sense, it is useful to redescribe certain practical actions in terms that affirm the identities of the other side.
Mm-hmm.
And so that requires you listen carefully and understand what the other side cares about. So my favorite example of this with respect to climate change is you don't tell the other side, you know, to sign on to alternative energy because it's going to save the whales, okay? Because
right.
That's not really that, or, you know, they don't care for the tree huggers, you know. They think that the environmentalists are putting whales and birds or whatever over people, and they have a living to make, right? And jobs are important, so they don't like all this job-killing environmental regulation. But there's another way to do it. You can appeal to their entrepreneurial sensibility. You know, you put solar on your rooftop and then you're no longer reliant on some big utility. And then you could sell power back to the utility and make money.
Right, right, yeah.
You know, I mean,
you can be off the grid or make money from the grid rather than, yeah.
And both of them, right? Off the grid appeals to individualism, making money does, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. It puts them in charge. It's very appealing. So there are many ways to make alternative energy appealing to the other side. And you should focus on that rather than focus on the things that make it appeal to your side.
Mm.
Think of ways in which these policies can appeal to the values of the other side. And it's important, not just that you're just trying to like bribe them or something,
right,
but also that you're affirming the legitimacy of their identity. There's nothing wrong with making money. That's a good thing. Here's an opportunity to make money, okay? Instead of thinking, oh, they're just money grubbing greedy people. No, 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 don't go there,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
bad. Everybody needs to make a living.
Yeah.
There's nothing wrong with that.
So as a way of facilitating this kind of more sort of sophisticated way of talking to the other side, is a social experiment that you reference about, you know, having constructive discourse across the divides within citizen deliberation sort of context. So along the line of what is a citizen jury, you get people to discuss what are otherwise hot button issues, but in a context that tries to strip them away from that kind of partisan language when, you know, people would have that kind of immediate negative reaction to something or positive reaction to something. And there you say, well, you can, you know, people can get to share their stories, their personal stories, how they've been affected by certain policies. You know, people that live in metropolitan areas probably don't know how the policies that they favor might affect farmers, for example, and so on. And as a result, you say that we can see that actually people's minds can change in that context. Can you talk a little bit about what is special about these forums that manage to facilitate discourse? And maybe the key question is, can we scale those up from a smaller setting?
So we have excellent evidence, both from deliberative polling, which is a kind of experiment, and from actual assemblies of citizens to discuss the issues of the day with some political impact, that it is possible to moderate the discussion in such a way to orient people to the facts rather than to some kind of esteem competition where people are just trying to jockey for position and assert their moral superiority to the other side. Okay. Now, whether it's a lab experiment or a real citizens assembly, the critical issues are you have to marginalize, basically get out of the room, any conflict entrepreneur, people who are trolling, harassing, insulting, piling on, shaming, right? All those people just have to be totally marginalized.
They're blocked from the start.
That's right, yeah. Right. And so that, you know, and there are people like that on both the left and the right. Okay, and they have to be marginalized. And then you have to make sure that people are not, you have to basically get people off identity expressive discourse, right? So they shouldn't be wearing partisan labels or anything like that. They should just
don't show up with your I love Hillary t-shirt.
Correct, right. Or yeah. Basket of deplorables, right? No. Don't go there, right? And then focus in particular, don't get citizens talking about their ideological worldviews. Because again, that's a more identity expressive discourse.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, have them talk about their own personal experience. What they know in person, not what they've heard on some media source or whatever, right? They got to talk about their own lives and their own struggles. Okay. And then what you find is people share those concerns across, everyone's worried about, you know, will they, you know, about making a living in a pandemic? You know, I mean, this is a real problem. How are my kids going to learn if it's all virtual? Okay. That's a problem. Everyone can recognize right. this. And then you learn people care about the flourishing of their families, about staying safe, okay, about affordable health care. These are all common concerns, okay? And once you see that the other side cares about the same issues in a general sense, that is, they're coping with certain problems that they feel maybe overwhelmed with, right? Then you can start a more fact-oriented discussion in which you make sure that the people, you know, who know something about social causes are from diverse cultural identities, okay? And then you can open people's minds because they no longer feel that their own identities are being threatened. The key to opening people's minds to the facts is to reassure them that their identities are not being threatened, okay? Mm. And then they're willing to hear. But in order to assure people that their identities are not being threatened, you have to show respect and empathy for them. You do that by listening, and I mean serious listening, okay, to their personal troubles and concern.
And it also involves showing some vulnerability, from what I understand, to the other side, right? Showing that you're also not, you haven't got everything figured out. You also face problems. And in that way, I think you say you come to seem less of a threat to people by showing them that, you know, you're also have your own struggles.
And the critical thing here is that populism, whether of the right or the left, is always a reaction to the feeling of a group of people that they're not being heard, mm-hmm. that their views are not being represented or respected. Okay. And so, however painful, and I accept that it's not for everybody, right? People face differential costs. So, you know, people have to think carefully about whether they want to enter such a process because it can be pretty rough.
Yeah, showing empathy to the other side for some people might be easier than some others.
Correct.
Depending on what their life experiences have been.
Exactly right. Yes.
So is this scalable? So, you know, you might say, well, face-to-face discussion, exchanging personal stories in the same room with people, you know, having a cup of tea or coffee and some cake. I imagine all these things take place in these situations. You know, this is a context which is conducive to developing feelings of empathy and association, you know, talking to people. But given that most of our discourse and mass communication these days does not take place in the physical space, takes place online, you think it is possible to generate similar results without having the luxury of face-to-face interaction?
That's a really great question. I want to point to some really great work that's being done by the political scientist, Kathy Kramer at University of Wisconsin. She's working with tech people to set up this piece of technology that allows people to communicate, just like citizens from all over the country, to communicate on these devices. So it's kind of like teleconferencing or something like that. Mm-hmm. But for ordinary people, not just for, you know,
executives,
scientific conventions and stuff. Right. And she gets them together to talk about their lives. And this is very important because, you know, the biggest divide actually in along populism is the divide between rural and urban. Mm. Right. Liberals uniformly. Right.
We have
are
sorted.
Concentrated in the big cities.
Yeah, we're geographically sorted.
And conservatives are out in ex-urban and rural, low population density. Okay, it's a very strong fact, and it's worldwide. But, you know, that distance has to be crossed, and we do have technology to do that. And she set up these recorders in public libraries, and then they just have people come in to talk about their lives and learn about what it's like in a very different part of the country, right, to live and what people's issues are and their experiences. You learn. Now, how much you can scale this up, we're not sure. But let me give another example from real deliberation now rather than lab experiments like deliberative polling. In Ireland, they adopted constitutional reform that opens opportunities up for citizens' assemblies to deliberate on major issues, mm-hmm. typically where the legislature is kind of gridlocked and really can't move forward. And there were some famous citizens' assemblies. You can look at them online. They're all there. They had a whole bunch of them. But the two ones that I think were most successful and transformative, they had a citizen assembly on whether to liberalize abortion law, which required, I think, a constitutional change. And another one, whether to permit gay marriage. And the most moving and important stuff on these citizens' assemblies for me was when they actually presented testimony from women who had or had contemplated abortion. Some of them decided against it. And they just talked about, like, in just rich detail, what was going through their minds when they made that decision one way or another. Mm-hmm. Okay. And they were very careful to have it balanced. So some of the women had an abortion, some decided against it. And people listen very respectfully, and then they discuss it. Now, what's important is that even though the number of citizens who I believe in Ireland were just selected by lottery, essentially. Okay. So they're a random representative population. Okay. Representative of Ireland as a whole, at least of the adults. And because you could view all this online and it was covered in the newspapers, people have some confidence in thinking that, well, look, like any group of Irish randomly selected, a representative group would have come to the same conclusion if they had spent all this time looking at all the evidence and testimony mm-hmm. that they had received, because it took multiple weekends, full weekends of the time of these citizens before they made their recommendation. But they're all sober, serious, sincere people. None of them had a political axe to grind. Because remember, these are ordinary citizens. We're not talking about politicians who have their own reasons of power to promote certain ideas. And so, you know, there's reasons to believe, to think that, well, if you were in the room, you probably would have converged just the way these Reddit people did.
This podcast is created in partnership with The Philosopher, the UK's longest-running public philosophy journal. The winter issue of The Philosopher is out, tackling one of philosophy's perennial puzzles, the concept of nothing. Read, among other things, an essay by Graham Priest, challenging the well-known philosophical platitude that nothing comes from nothing, as well as an essay from one of our regular contributors, Chiara Ricciardone, on whether philosophy can change the world. If you'd like to order a copy of the latest issue and subscribe to the journal, go to www.thephilosopher1923.org. I want to ask a kind of question that is a little bit maybe, you know, expresses my own biases, or I'm sure some people listening to this might think similar things, which is that throughout your talks, you know, on this topic, you present the obstacles to a sensible form of public discourse as a problem that is caused by both sides of the political divide. It's not just right-wingers, it's also the liberals, it's also... So someone might say, well, does it not matter that ultimately, you know, one side is more often right about the facts, say, about the big kind of politically polarizing things like, you know, whether the elections of 2020 were fraudulent or not, or whether climate change is real. And also one side's happens to have maybe politics that are more compassionate or more empathetic to begin with, which could be more conducive to addressing questions of justice and suffering. Is there a danger of doing this kind of both-sidism thing here?
Here's my biggest point. The problem we face is that both sides are looking at what I call second-order questions. That is, who's better than who? Rather than first order questions, which is we have these problems we need to solve, like the pandemic, like unaffordable health care in the United States or in Britain, maybe long wait times to get access to health care or insufficient funding of the national health system, right? Everybody has a stake in this, right? We got to focus on the first order concern, which is the thing that's addressed by public policy. You should never ask public policy to adjudicate who's better than who at the group level. It's appalling. It's totally contrary to democratic norms for politicians to talk about who's better than who. And let's keep in mind that both sides do that. Hillary Clinton's stump speech for her 2016 election was the basket of deplorables. where she said, yeah, half of Trump's supporters, they're racist, they're bigots, they're irredeemable. Ah, appalling. Yeah,
I think especially that last bit.
Absolutely appalling. And I'm saying that not because it didn't work, although it didn't work. But is that this is so contrary to a Democratic ethos to do that. She campaigned on, we're better than them. We're more empathetic. Well, is she really like more empathetic to the people who are gripped by fear? So let's keep in mind again, for the left to open its hearts to the other side, they have to see that that hatred is stemming from fear. Okay. Trump, in his 2016 campaign, had a group of so-called angel moms. Do you know who the angel moms were?
I haven't heard about that, actually, no.
Okay. So these were women who had family members who had been murdered by... undocumented immigrants.
That rings a bell.
Okay. And so, and these angel moms followed him from one campaign event to the next, right? What is he doing? He's stoking fear, right? If you think.
Exploiting fear. Yeah.
And he said repeatedly that immigrants coming over the Mexican border are murderers and rapists. And of course, it's propaganda. So, yes, he was stoking fear and using propagandistic methods, but that doesn't mean that the fear wasn't genuine. And in order to address people on immigration, the first thing you have to do is to take the fear seriously, even if it is ungrounded, because to dismiss it is to make them think, you don't care about people like us. Don't tell me you're the empathetic one because you're not caring about me.
I think this is a really important point, that even if you believe that the concerns are unjustified and that they are wrong in some way, that you still have to take them seriously. Otherwise, you don't get started talking to the other side. I have a couple of questions on your favorite topic, which is John Dewey.
Well, you know, I'm not called the John Dewey professor for nothing.
Exactly, right? Yes.
Just because he is my favorite philosopher.
The question I wanted to ask you about Dewey is that he is obviously part of the American pragmatist tradition, and you say that this approach that you're taking to the problem of citizen communication is a kind of pragmatist approach. What do you mean by that? And can you tell us in what way it is pragmatist?
So if we step back and think about pragmatism more generally, and here I'm focusing on pragmatism and ethics and political philosophy. It takes a skeptical position to the idea of like trying to figure out through pure reasoning what the fundamental moral principles are, and instead wants to replace the quest for a kind of purely rational deduction of first principles of morality with a method of inquiring about what rules we should live by. And the method is experimental. So Dewey, and I totally endorse this view, that we can test moral propositions in just the same way that we test scientific claims. And the idea is, if you propose a certain moral principle, how do you test it? You act in accordance with it and see if you are satisfied with the results. Okay. And typically what we find is, you know, people forever have been advancing certain ideas for how to live as the way to live. Okay. But then when people try to live that way, they learn there are all kinds of unanticipated consequences that are not that great. Okay. And, you know, you can tinker and modify and add exceptions and so forth, but sometimes you just come to the conclusion that, no, it just gets it wrong. this is just not an acceptable way to live. And, of course, for moral inquiry, where we're asking about what we owe to each other, this testing has to take place collectively. Because a certain role might be perfectly satisfactory to some, but totally unsatisfactory to others, right? And so the others for whom its experience is awful, right? have to be able to communicate that, and sometimes in pretty strident ways. And that's why we need social movements, right? If the people who are happy with the roles as they are in a position of power, like, they just don't listen. Right. And so that's why democracy is in the streets.
Right.
That's why we need social movements.
That's, yeah. So that's something you highlight about Dewey and how he thinks about democracy, that democracy isn't just voting every 4 years. It isn't just about the institutions of democracy, parliaments and the legislature. It is a kind of culture. And you talk about how Dewey thinks, you know, you need to keep this culture of democracy alive through civil society. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, apart from kind of, you know, demonstrating in the streets, what are the ways that one can contribute to the culture of democracy in our kind of day-to-day lives before we exercise our voting rights when the time comes?
Well, we do have to talk to people who are not like-minded. Mm. Now, and doing that doesn't necessarily have to mean talking about politics.
So it's a kind of democratic obligation to engage with people of the other side.
Yeah.
Right.
But we need facilitating conditions. I do think that geographical segregation of the sides has made this extremely difficult, right? Because it's hard to travel. It's expensive and time consuming.
Right.
And I also think social media, right, are optimizing for values that are actually actively hostile to democracy. So social media isn't great. And that's why, right, we're in a desperate need for other forums for people to get together. And again, like, not even necessarily talk about politics, just talk about their lives. Mm-hmm. Now, it would be even better, right, if we had non-political activities around which we could form. So philosopher Bob Talese has talked about this a lot, is that what we really need is, you know,
more clubs,
like, if only sports teams, yeah. Right? But yeah, you know, we don't even go to the same churches if we go to church at all, right? So church isn't a place for people of different views to get together either. And that's the problem, is that everything's been sorted and segregated so that people of different political parties, right, they have no opportunities to engage.
To bring it back to philosophy, one of the things that struck me in your talk was that you say, well, philosophy is definitely a terrible model for public discourse, right? Philosophy is combative. It looks to decisively refute the other side. You have a great Nozick quote here. It goes something like, well, the ultimate ideal of philosophical arguments is when you refute the other with a devastating argument so that they drop dead. Yeah. And you say, well, that's not really maybe, you know, a great model for political discourse. Philosophy doesn't care about perspectives, you know, where people are coming from. It's conducted in abstract principle terms and so on. Doesn't care about lived experience as much. Now, my question to you is, if this is a type of debate which is terrible for our politics, is there a question about whether it's also terrible for our philosophy?
Well, look, I do think that there is way too much philosophical argumentation that's just oriented to refutation and top, you know, I can top you. Yeah. Debate is just like a horrible way to do stuff, I think. But, you know, there's many ways to do philosophy. So I'm not going to condemn philosophy. Like, I'm a philosopher. But there are other ways to do it. And I just want to cite somebody who I think just has a much better way of approaching this. A beautiful example of political philosophy that's really engaged. And that's Susan Neiman's lovely book, Learning from the Germans, Race and the Memory of Evil. So she's writing as a white Jewish woman who grew up in the South in the United States, who's been living in Germany now for a number of years and was quite struck by how the Germans came to terms with the evil of the Holocaust, morally speaking, and have encoded that in their historical memory in a way that white Americans and America generally, that is at the political level, has never really come to terms with slavery and its contemporary legacies of systematic racism And what by coming to terms, I mean actual moral accountability, apologies and reparations. The toxicity of politics today is the refusal to come to terms. And the beautiful thing she does in this book is she's not just giving a whole bunch of abstract arguments. She's talking to people, to Germans, and to people in the American South who are trying to move to a better way of being, right? Mm-hmm. And engaging with their experiences. And they're making arguments in the course of this, but it's all embedded in the lived experience of coming to terms. And so it's rooted in a way that purely abstract argument over principles is not. And, you know, so she's developing her argument through an extensive engagement with a bunch of different people who are trying to cope with the problem. You see, it's a beautiful piece of philosophy, but it's much more discursive than we're used to in standard analytic philosophy, where you just have these, you know, isolated premises, right? And then you just sort of look at objections and replies to this tightly, narrowly constructed premise, right? That you could express in a single sentence. Like, no, moral life is too messy to encapsulate in just a single moral principle.
What is one reading you'd recommend from the pragmatist tradition or Dewey specifically on political philosophy and the culture of democracy?
I have a recommendation for a reading. It's my absolute best, most favorite piece that of public philosophy that John Dewey ever wrote. You can Google it and pick up a copy by John Dewey. It's called Creative Democracy, The Task Before Us. And you can get a PDF. It's it's just by Googling it. It's such a beautiful expression of how to talk to our fellow citizens and the importance of doing so. And in fact, I knew you were going to ask that question, so I popped up and I just want to give you a quote. First of all, he's writing this in 1939 when democracy is collapsing all across Europe and where there's a rising fascist movement in the United States. And he's basically telling his fellow citizens, don't think that democracy is just a set of legal institutions that carry on without active citizen participation. No. Maintaining democracy is the job of the people, because it's not just a set of legal institutions, it's a way of life. So what is that way of life? And just a couple quotes. Democracy is a way of life controlled by a working faith in the possibilities of human nature, as that nature is exhibited in every human being, irrespective of race, color, sex, birth, and family, or of material or cultural wealth. This faith may be enacted in statutes, but it is only on paper unless it is put in force in the attitudes which human beings display to one another in all the incidents and relations of daily life. To denounce Nazism for intolerance, cruelty, and stimulation of hatred amounts to fostering insincerity if, in our personal relations to other persons, if in our daily walk and conversation, we are moved by racial, color, or other class prejudice, indeed by anything, save a generous belief in their possibilities as human beings, a belief which brings with it the need for providing conditions which will enable those capacities to reach fulfillment. There it all is in a nutshell. Please read Dewey. It's beautiful and it speaks to both sides.
Elizabeth Anderson, thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure. I love talking to you. Thank you.
If you'd like to listen to future episodes of The Philosopher and the News, subscribe and follow us wherever you listen to podcasts. If you enjoyed this episode, please spread the word and leave us a review. It really does help others find the podcast. Some of you have already been leaving reviews, and I'm really grateful for your comments. A reviewer from France wrote, "This is a wonderful podcast, sensible, calm, rational, not drama-seeking. I find it resets my mind after being bombarded by today's mainstream media. Thank you for this. Well, thank you for taking the time to leave this review and for your kind words. I really appreciate them. If you would also like to leave a review on Apple Podcasts and help spread the word, please do so. It would really help the show in its very beginning. Next week, I'll be talking to political philosopher Jeffrey Howard on his award-winning essay on dangerous speech, Donald Trump's ban from Twitter and Facebook, and whether social media platforms should be regulating online speech when they aren't ultimately accountable for their decisions. I'm Alexis Papazoglou, and this was The Philosopher and the News. Speak again next week.